7. Earth. Why do continents drift? Why do climates change? Nothing feels more solid or more permanent than the ground beneath our feet. But this feeling is an illusion. The ground beneath our feet has not always been there, nor will it always be there. It started out as molten rock, and it will someday return to molten rock, recycled deep within the earth. Far from our everyday experience of the earth as inert and eternal, the earth is forever moving and forever changing. When the earth first formed, 4.5 billion years ago, there was no ground. The entire planet was molten. Only later, as the earth cooled, did its surface harden into solid rock. This rock then broke into several massive plates, which geologists call tectonic plates. Tectonic plates glide along a layer of hot, viscous material and are continually breaking, fusing, and colliding, reshaping the Earth's surface in the process. Even today, these plates and the continents embedded within continue to move under our feet, though this motion is so gradual that we need laser-equipped satellites to measure it directly. The first person to hypothesize that the continents move, or had at least once moved, was the cartographer Abraham Ortelius. In the 16th century, he noted that the east coast of the Americas seemed oddly similar to the west coast of Africa and Europe. Others echoed this observation in the centuries that followed, but it wasn't paid any heed until the early 20th century, when geophysicist Alfred Wegener marshaled the observation as one of several pieces of evidence in support of continental drift. Wegener's theory of continental drift is a quintessential example of the triumph of evidence over intuition. The prevailing intuition of a historically uniform Earth was strong, but Wegener's evidence was vast and varied. First, the geological record indicated that coastal rock formations are often more similar across continents than within continents. Rock formations along the eastern coast of South America, for example, are more similar to those along the western coast of Africa than to those along the other coasts of South America. This pattern holds not only for rock formations, but also for coal deposits, mineral deposits, and mountain ranges. Geological features that stop when they hit an ocean seemingly reappear thousands of miles away. Second, the paleontological record indicated that areas now characterized by tropical or subtropical climates, South Africa, India, Australia, were once covered by glaciers. But at the same time in geological history, there were no glaciers covering regions of the world now characterized by Arctic or subarctic climates, Canada, Siberia. If proximity to the Earth's poles determines climate, then these regions would seem to have swapped places. Third, much as Ortelius had suggested centuries earlier, a geometric analysis of the continents indicated that they would interlock if pushed together. Africa would form the center of this global jigsaw puzzle, bordered by Eurasia to its east, South America to its west, North America to its north, and Antarctica and Australia to its south. In addition to these geological data, Wegener also gathered some compelling data from biology. By the early 20th century, zoologists had documented several instances of the same animals living on geographically isolated landmasses. Lemurs, for instance, are found today only on the island of Madagascar, an island located off the eastern coast of Africa, yet lemur fossils have been discovered in India, which is separated from Madagascar by over 3,000 miles of ocean. To explain how lemurs migrated from India to Madagascar, one zoologist postulated that India and Madagascar were once connected by a now sunken continent, a continent he dubbed Lemuria. The name Lemuria sounds almost too fanciful to be taken seriously, but postulating lost continents or land bridges was serious business in 19th century zoology. Without continental drift, land bridges were needed to explain how animals of the same genus, or even the same species, came to live in places as distant as North Africa and the West Indies beetles, South Africa and South America, earthworms, and South America and Australia, opossums. The land bridge theory was also needed to explain how extinct species, Cambrian trilobites, Permian ferns, Triassic lizards, left behind fossils on opposite sides of vast, uncrossable oceans. Wegener's argument was, in essence, an exercise in pattern matching. He showed that despite the scattered locations of the Earth's continents, their geological patterns, paleontological patterns, and zoological patterns matched when brought together. Wegener stressed the importance of these data with a metaphor. It is just as if we were to refit the torn pieces of a newspaper by matching their edges and then check whether the lines of print ran smoothly across. If they do, there is nothing left but to conclude that the pieces were in fact joined in this way. The geophysicist further argued that the preponderance of evidence and diversity of evidence was too great to be coincidental. If only one line of the newspaper was available for the test, we would still have found a high probability for the accuracy of the fit. But if we have n lines, this probability is raised to the nth power. Despite the evidence, Wegener's theory was never accepted within his lifetime. Geologists were skeptical of the theory, not because they were convinced that the Earth was unchanging. They already knew that the Earth had begun its existence in a molten state, that its interior was still hotter and more fluid than its exterior, that its land masses eroded and deformed over time, that its oceans had once covered more land than they currently cover, and that its mountains now stand where no mountains had stood before. Rather, they were skeptical of Wegener's theory because they were unable to reconcile the theory with its implications. Geologists of the early 20th century were willing to concede that the Earth's crust could wrinkle, crack, or fold, but they were unwilling to concede that it could rearrange itself into radically new configurations. By what mechanism could entire continents plow their way through the solid seafloor? Around the time that Wegener first unveiled his theory, one of his contemporaries, Bailey Willis, summarized the state of the field as follows. "The great ocean basins are permanent features of the Earth's surface, and they have existed, where they now are, with moderate changes of outline since the waters first gathered." In that same paper, published in the preeminent journal Science, Willis entirely dismissed the importance of the zoological record. "When we find a German fauna in New York or a Russian fauna in Western North America, what do such findings signify? Simply that the surviving species of a fauna have remained unchanged during a longer or a shorter period, either at home or during migration, or that variations have developed similarly in two provinces from an ancestral stock similarly conditioned. In short, they signify nothing that geologists need to pay attention to." Another geologist of the time, Roland T. Chamberlain, dismissed Wegener's hypothesis as footloose, saying the hypothesis took considerable liberty with our globe and was not bound by restrictions or tied down by awkward, ugly facts. According to Chamberlain, "If we are to believe Wegener's hypothesis, we must forget everything which has been learned in the last 70 years and start over again." But start over they did. Wegener's theory brought to light phenomena that geologists of the time were unable to explain and thus investigated over the following decades. Those investigations rendered Wegener's incredible hypothesis credible, first through the discovery of mid-ocean ridges, which indicate that ocean basins are not a permanent feature of the Earth's surface, but are malleable surfaces that spread and contract, and second through the discovery of magnetic stripes on the ocean's floor, which indicate that currents of molten rock deep within the Earth's interior have changed the magnetic properties of the Earth's crust as that crust forms anew at the boundaries of tectonics plates. In just 40 years, Wegener's theory went from footloose folly to paradigmatic truth, at least for scientists. For non-scientists, Wegener's theory remains confusing to this day. The idea that we live on drifting, deforming plates is even less believable than the idea covered in Chapter 6 that we live on an orbiting, rotating sphere. The professional geologists of Wegener's time knew a great deal about geological processes and geological history. If they were reluctant to accept continental drift, then it's easy to see why non-geologists are even more reluctant. Our naive conceptions of the Earth are much less dynamic than those of Wegener's contemporaries. We see the Earth as essentially an inert chunk of rock, solid and eternal. To accept continental drift, we must reconceptualize the Earth from a static object characterized by small and infrequent change, example, shifting coastlines, eroding mountains, to a dynamic system characterized by large and continual change, example, sinking landmasses, colliding continents. Over the past few decades, it has become apparent that students in geoscience classes do not leave these classes with a modern tectonic understanding of the Earth, but rather maintain their naive, static understanding of the Earth from the beginning of their classes to the end. One wide-scale study found that geoscience education has virtually no effect on geoscience misconceptions. The study involved 2,500 students enrolled in one of 43 different courses in 32 colleges. Each student was administered a test of his or her understanding of geologic time, plate tectonics, and the Earth's interior, both before instruction and after. Before instruction, students answered an average of 8 questions correctly out of 19. After instruction, they answered an average of 9 questions correctly. The results were the same, regardless of whether the students were enrolled in a community college, a 4-year public university, or a 4-year private university, and whether they were enrolled in a course on physical geology or historical geology, or something more specialized like geology for engineers. Frustratingly, the strongest predictor of students' final performance was not their major, their school, or their course, but how well they had performed on the pretest. It was as though they had hardly taken a class at all. Part of the problem in understanding a geological process like continental drift is that the phenomena explained by this process are not observable to the naked eye, nor are they even known to the average person. Few people know that fossils of the same species have been unearthed on distant continents, or that rock formations on distant continents have been found to match in size and structure. And when we become aware of such phenomena, they do not cry out for explanation in the same way that other, more salient phenomena do. Example, freezing, falling, boiling, or burning, as discussed in earlier chapters. Geological ideas are treated more as curiosities than as explanations. We assimilate them without connecting them to the phenomena they are meant to explain. Take, for example, common misconceptions about plate tectonics. Although plate tectonics explains several kinds of large-scale changes to the Earth's crust, many students fail to connect the ideas of plates and crust. They assume instead that plates are located in the Earth's interior, stacked in layers or arrayed as a shield around the Earth's molten core. If students do accept that the Earth's plates are contiguous with its surface, they often fail to accept that the plates move laterally, assuming instead that they move vertically, rising and falling, as experienced in an earthquake, or circularly, spinning around a fixed axis at the plate's center. Contrast this with geological phenomena that we can experience, like earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, and geysers. These phenomena are not quaint curiosities. They are dramatic and potentially deadly, and we want to know why they occur. But these phenomena are not simple. They involve a series of causal interactions, many of which are far removed from the event itself, both in time and in space. Consider, from a safe distance, the eruption of a typical volcano. At least 8 steps are involved. 1. The Earth's tectonic plates move. 2. This motion causes one plate to be pushed beneath another. 3. Friction and pressure build between the colliding plates, causing heat. 4. rock within the plates begins to melt. 5. The melted rock, or magma, has a lower density than that of the surrounding rock and thus rises within the Earth's crust. 6. Rising magma then pools in subterranean chambers. 7. The rock surrounding these chambers weakens and cracks. And 8. Pressure builds within the magma chambers until the magma is pushed through the cracks into the atmosphere. Integrating this series of events into a complete causal sequence is not easy. In one study, researchers taught a group of college students this sequence of events and then asked them to recount the sequence in a follow-up essay on why Mount St. Helens erupted. On average, students could recount only 3 of the 8 events. There were, however, substantial differences in the number of events recounted by individual students. Some students recounted as few as 1, and others recounted as many as 6. Those differences were not random. Students with strong visuospatial skills recalled more of the causal chain than those with weak visuospatial skills. That is, students who performed well on an independent measure of visuospatial ability, a dynamic object-tracking task, also integrated more geophysical events into their understanding of volcanic eruptions. This association held even when the instructional materials included illustrations, which eliminated the need to construct mental images. Understanding geophysical processes requires more than just envisioning those processes. It requires integrating them into a series of interactions. Geophysical systems are highly dynamic, and learning those systems requires dynamic thinking. Another aspect of geoscience that makes geophysical systems difficult to understand is the immense amounts of time involved. We can look at rocks on a beach and understand that they will eventually be beaten into sand, but it's difficult to appreciate this idea viscerally. Geologists call the time implicit in geological events deep time, to differentiate it from our lived experience of time. Deep time and lived time are as different from one another as galaxies are from atoms, but the difference is often lost on us. Ask yourself, is dirt from the dinosaur period the same dirt that we find today? No, not even close. But the question may have given you pause. If our dirt is not the same as the dinosaurs' dirt, where did the dinosaurs' dirt go? And where did our dirt come from? Our intuition is that dirt is dirt, as eternal as the earth itself. It's an intuition we share with children. As one fifth grader explained in an interview with a geoscientist, it's possible for dirt to live that long because people would get killed and stuff, and they might just die. And plants, anybody could smush them, or a tree could be cut down. But dirt so small, nobody would really want to do anything to it. And if they do anything, nothing would really happen. You can't kill dirt. It's just there forever. Surprisingly, dirt is not there forever. It is eroded by wind and rain, washed away by floods, scraped away by glaciers, covered by inorganic matter, silt, soot, dust, covered by organic matter, rotting animals, decomposing plants, heaved upward in earthquakes, buried in landslides, and recycled into the earth itself. Dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, and that's a lot of time for dirt to change. But we rarely see any of those changes unfold before our eyes. The time scale of a human life is exponentially shorter than the time scale of most geological events, and we find it difficult to connect the geological features around us, dirt, mountains, islands, canyons, to the historically ancient processes that gave rise to those features. Charles Darwin was one of the first people to note the difficulty of understanding such processes. In The Origin of Species, he wrote, "We are always slow in admitting any great change of which we do not see the immediate steps. The difficulty is the same as that felt by so many geologists, when Charles Lyell first insisted that long lines of inland cliffs had been formed and great valleys excavated by the slow action of the coast waves. The mind cannot possibly grasp the full meaning of the term of 100 million years. It cannot add up and perceive the full effects of many slight variations accumulated during an almost infinite number of generations. Darwin's focus was on changes in the biological world, which unfold over vast periods of unseen time, just like changes in the geological world. Consider the following milestones in the evolution of life. Can you order them from most ancient to least ancient? First appearance of hominids. First appearance of life. First appearance of mammals. First appearance of primates. First appearance of vertebrates. These events are not too difficult to order. Their sequence is inherent in their content. Life had to emerge before life with backbones, vertebrates. Vertebrates had to emerge before warm-blooded vertebrates, mammals. Mammals had to emerge before prehensile tree-dwelling mammals, primates, and primates had to emerge before upright bipedal primates, hominids. Now for a much tougher question. Which of these events occurred approximately 200 million years ago? If you're like most people, you picked either the appearance of vertebrates or the appearance of life itself. But those events actually occurred much earlier, 525 million years ago and 3.8 billion years ago, respectively. The event that occurred 200 million years ago was the appearance of mammals, which most people estimate as having occurred only 10 million years ago. Our estimates are off by a whole order of magnitude, as are our estimates for many other ancient events. The formation of the earth, the formation of the moon, the appearance of fish, the appearance of trees, the extinction of woolly mammoths, and the extinction of dinosaurs. This last event, the extinction of dinosaurs, is particularly vexing. The amount of time that has passed between the extinction of dinosaurs, 65 million years ago, and the appearance of modern humans, 200,000 years ago, is equivalent to 912,000 human lifespans. Yet, millions of Americans believe that humans and dinosaurs once coexisted. This belief is fueled in part by popular depictions of human-dinosaur coexistence in books, The Lost World, Danny the Dinosaur, cartoons, The Flintstones, Denver the Last Dinosaur, and movies, 1 Million Years B.C., The Good Dinosaur. Humans and dinosaurs could coexist in the future if we clone them, as depicted in the movie Jurassic Park, but we never coexisted with dinosaurs in the past. Some of the strongest proponents of the myth that humans and dinosaurs once coexisted are creationists, or those who believe that God created humans and all other organisms in their current form, no evolution required. The Creationist Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, actually contains a saddled triceratops that children are encouraged to ride. Creationists advocate for human and dinosaur coexistence because this idea allows them to explain how dinosaurs left fossils in a world ostensibly populated by humans since its creation, or, more precisely, since its sixth day of creation. Religion has imposed many constraints on geology, constraints on how old the Earth is, where the Earth came from, and where it is located in the cosmos at large. But the constraint that humans coexisted with dinosaurs is perhaps the strangest. It would be simpler to deny the existence of dinosaurs flat out, as creationists did when dinosaur fossils were first discovered, but doing so nowadays would be a death knell for the movement. Dinosaurs and their fossils are too ingrained in popular culture for even the most religious individuals to deny their existence. Dinosaurs must be embraced and reinterpreted. One such reinterpretation has made waves on the internet. It's a page from a coloring book, presumably for children. the page depicts Jesus riding a Tyrannosaurus Rex and is captioned, "Even though we know dinosaurs survived the flood on Noah's Ark, we don't know if Jesus ever rode them, but he probably did." The idea that Jesus rode a T-Rex is preposterous, but so should be the idea that ancient people rode Triceratops. Conceptualizing the Earth as a dynamic system changing over deep time is critical not only for understanding its geology and its ecology, but also for understanding its climate. It is now abundantly clear that the Earth's climate is changing because of human activity, and the pathways involved in the change are complex and interlinked. Humans are releasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at unprecedented rates through the burning of carbon-rich fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. The additional carbon dioxide slows the release of heat from the atmosphere by trapping infrared radiation, a low-energy form of light, thereby increasing the Earth's temperature. Higher temperatures then set in motion a cascade of meteorological events. Polar ice caps melt, raising sea levels and altering ocean currents. Altered ocean currents change regional weather patterns, rendering polar regions colder and equatorial regions hotter. Changing weather patterns also affect how much rain falls and where it falls, leading to droughts in some regions and floods in others. Coastal regions are particularly likely to flood because of the combined effects of higher sea levels and more powerful tropical storms. In short, climate change affects all atmospheric systems: oceans, glaciers, currents, winds, sea levels, air pressure, precipitation. Things are much simpler from a layperson's point of view. Climate is considered synonymous with weather, and climate change synonymous with hotter weather. This conflation of climate and weather was notoriously illustrated by Republican Senator James Inhofe, who brought a snowball onto the Senate floor in an attempt to show that global warming is a hoax. "We keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record," he announced. "But you know what this is? It's a snowball from outside here. So it's very, very cold out." The argument implicit in this stunt was that if today's weather is not unusually warm, then the Earth's climate cannot be heating up either. Senator Inhofe is not alone in conflating weather and climate. Public acceptance of climate change has been shown to fluctuate with the weather, with more people accepting climate change on hot days than on cold days. In one study, researchers asked people to rate how certain they were that global warming is happening and how much they personally worried about global warming. The researchers then compared those ratings to weather reports from the day each participant completed the survey, calculating deviations between daily temperatures and historical averages. Participants who completed the survey on days that were warmer than usual expressed more certainty about global warming and more concern about global warming than did participants who completed the survey on days that were cooler than usual. Participants were also asked to donate some of their payment for completing the survey to a nonprofit dedicated to reducing global warming, Clean Air, Cool Planet, and the size of those donations tracked the weather as well. The warmer the day, the more the participants donated. The same findings have been observed outside the lab on a much larger scale. U.S. polling agencies like Gallup, Harris, the ABC Woods Institute, and the Pew Center have been measuring public acceptance of climate change for nearly 20 years. Public acceptance has increased in general, but it still fluctuates by sizable margins from one poll to the next. Those fluctuations turn out to be related to the weather. Polls taken within a year of unusually warm weather reveal greater public acceptance of climate change than did polls taken within a year of unusually cool weather. Media coverage of climate change follows the same pattern. Climate-related editorial and opinion pieces published in major U.S. newspapers within a year of unusually warm weather expressed greater concern over climate change than those published within a year of unusually cool weather. Fluctuations in weather are only tenuously connected to climate change, but they are a driving force behind people's concern over climate change nonetheless. In some ways, our conflation of weather and climate doesn't really matter in the long run, given that unusually hot days are increasingly outnumbering unusually cold days, which should raise concerns about climate change across the board. Still, naive conceptions of climate change are problematic because they breed equally naive solutions. For starters, many people refuse to believe that humans are causing climate change and thus refuse to take part in the solution, a misapprehension we will revisit later in the chapter. Others accept that humans are causing climate change, but fail to understand how. Humans' relationship with the environment is often reduced to an overly simplistic dichotomy between activities labeled as environmentally friendly or green and activities labeled as environmentally harmful or brown. Commonly cited green activities include recycling, planting trees, turning off lights, picking up litter, and commuting by bicycle. Commonly cited brown activities include driving cars, taking long showers, using pesticides, dumping chemicals into the ocean, and spraying aerosol cans. All activities with environmental consequences are seen as related to climate change, though some activities, such as picking up litter, using pesticides, or spraying aerosol cans, are not related, at least not directly. And among activities actually related to climate change, some have larger consequences than others. Yet, we don't care much about the difference. Transportation, for instance, is estimated to contribute 14% of our carbon emissions, whereas waste is estimated to contribute only 4%. But we are significantly more inclined to tackle the problem of waste, buying less or recycling more, than to tackle the problem of transportation, using public transportation or minimizing air travel, even when we explicitly acknowledge that the former is less consequential than the latter. The sacrifices entailed by our adjusting our transportation habits are too unpalatable to take on, so we delude ourselves into thinking that separating our recyclables from our trash will save the planet. But it won't. Not on its own. The behavioral changes needed to reduce global warming are as life-altering as the consequences of not making those changes. We know this fact implicitly, but have yet to embrace it explicitly, opting instead to deny that climate change is serious, or even to deny that climate change is occurring. In case you haven't noticed, America is deeply divided over climate change. About 16% of Americans are alarmed about climate change, 29% are concerned, 25% are cautious, 9% are disengaged, 13% are doubtful, and 8% are dismissive. The climate science community calls these groups global warming's six Americas. The size of each group has remained roughly the same from 2008 to the present, despite dramatic increases in the evidence for global warming and the publicity surrounding that evidence. Global warming's six Americas differ not just in their attitudes toward climate change, but also in their climate-related beliefs and behaviors. Those on the alarmed side of the spectrum are more likely than those on the dismissive side to agree, 1, that global warming is happening, 2, that most scientists think that global warming is happening, 3, that global warming is caused by human activity, 4, that it is worrisome, 5, that it is harmful, 6, that it will impact future generations, and 7, that it can be reduced if we take the right actions. Demographically, global warming's six Americas are quite similar. They vary little by age, income, race, or gender. A young, high-income Latino man is just as likely to deny global warming as is an old, low-income Caucasian woman. But what does separate the six Americas is religion and politics. Those on the alarmed side of the spectrum are more liberal in their religious and political views, whereas those on the dismissive side are more conservative. Clearly, there are sociological factors at play in the rejection of climate change, factors that are deep-rooted and far-reaching. But are there also conceptual factors? Do those who dismiss climate change understand what climate change actually is? Studies by psychologist Michael Ranney and his colleagues suggest that these people do not. When Ranney and colleagues asked hundreds of Americans to explain the causes of global warming, very few people could do so. Only 15% even mentioned greenhouse gases in their explanations. Ranney then provided the participants with a 400-word description of the chemical and physical mechanisms behind climate change and measured how that information affected people's climate-related beliefs and attitudes. The full description can be found at howglobalwarmingworks.org. But Ranney summarizes it as follows. Earth transforms sunlight's visible light energy into infrared light energy, which leaves Earth slowly because it is absorbed by greenhouse gases. When people produce greenhouse gases, energy leaves Earth even more slowly, raising Earth's temperature. Providing people with this information has two effects. First, it leads to more accurate beliefs about the nature of global warming, beliefs they retain for at least several weeks later. Second, it leads to increased acceptance of global warming, regardless of a person's politics. Even politically conservative individuals are more inclined to accept the reality of global warming after learning about the causes of global warming, though not by a lot. Political blinders are hard to remove. Another type of information that increases acceptance of global warming, and climate change more generally, is information about the scientific consensus surrounding these issues. When asked to estimate the percentage of scientists who agree that human-induced carbon emissions cause climate change, people typically estimate between 60% and 70%, which is far below the true value of 97%. Nevertheless, when told flat out that 97% of scientists agree that human carbon emissions cause climate change, we immediately revise our beliefs, endorsing the statement, human carbon emissions cause climate change, significantly more than if told nothing about the current scientific consensus. The reason that consensus information has such a powerful effect on our beliefs about climate change is the same reason that our clothing preferences are shaped by what other people are wearing, and our eating preferences are shaped by what other people are eating. Peer pressure. Humans are social animals. We care deeply about the beliefs and attitudes of other humans and whether our beliefs and attitudes align with theirs. We are particularly sensitive to consensus information about empirical matters because we construe consensus as a proxy for truth. The more widespread a belief is perceived to be, the more we are inclined to hold that belief ourselves. Consensus information influences not only our acceptance of climate change, but also our commitment to reducing climate change. In one study, participants were asked to indicate which of several organizations should be doing more to address global warming, including local government, state government, national government, and corporate industry. They were also asked to indicate whether they support several climate-related policies, including regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant, requiring electric companies to utilize renewable energy sources, providing tax rebates for purchasing energy-efficient vehicles, and increasing taxes on gasoline. The more participants believed correctly that global warming is scientifically uncontroversial, the more they believed that public organizations should take action against it and that public policies should be implemented to further those actions. Then the more participants believed correctly that global warming is caused by human activity, the more they believed that global warming is a serious and immediate problem and that it can be reduced if humans take collective action. Psychologists have thus identified two routes to increasing public acceptance of climate change: the cognitive route of teaching the causal mechanisms behind climate change, and the social route of emphasizing the scientific consensus surrounding climate change. Both routes are effective, yet we often take neither when attempting to raise public concern over climate change. Our default strategy is to guilt trip, to cloak discussions of climate change in a rhetoric of harm and injustice. The Earth is cast as a victim, in need of protection from exploitation, and humans are cast as the transgressors, in need of more self-restraint. A prime example of this rhetoric can be seen in President Obama's address to the nation during the week of Earth Day 2015. "Wednesday is Earth Day," he announced, "a day to appreciate and protect this precious planet we call home. This is the only planet we've got, and years from now, I want to be able to look our children and grandchildren in the eye and tell them that we did everything we could to protect it." This rhetoric may resonate at an emotional level, but it is unlikely to resonate at a conceptual level, because we don't really think of the Earth as something that needs protection. How can we harm an object that is seemingly eternal? And why should concerns over harming an eternal object take precedence over the harm we do to ourselves by denying our energy-related needs and desires? A more conceptually effective rhetoric, in addition to emphasizing mechanism information or consensus information, embraces our perception of the Earth as eternal and thereby emphasizes the Earth's indifference to humans rather than its dependence on humans. Geological systems have operated for billions of years before the appearance of humans and will continue to operate under new conditions, such as higher levels of atmospheric carbon and higher global temperatures, regardless of how those conditions affect our preferred manner of existence. This more realistic rhetoric is nicely captured by a cartoon that circulated on the Internet around the same time that President Obama made his speech. In it, a human apologizes to Mother Gaia, a personification of the Earth, for humankind's harmful actions. Human: "Mother Gaia, I come on behalf of all humans to apologize for destroying nature and beg for forgiveness." Gaia: "Oh, my beloved self-centered humans, nature is adaptable. No matter what you do to it, it will simply change and take on new forms. It has survived worse things than you. You are, however, in the process of changing it so much that you can't live in it. You're not killing nature. You're killing yourself." Human: "What?" Gaia: "You're screwing yourself over, and you won't be missed." This chapter marks the conclusion of our discussion of intuitive theories of the physical world. The next 6 chapters are devoted to intuitive theories of the biological world. To recap, we covered the following physical theories. 1. An intuitive theory of matter, where material substances are viewed as holistic and discrete rather than particulate and divisible. 2. An intuitive theory of energy, where heat, light, and sound are viewed as material substances rather than emergent properties of a system's microscopic components. 3. An intuitive theory of gravity, where weight is viewed as an intrinsic property of objects rather than a relation between mass and a gravitational field. 4. An intuitive theory of motion, where force is viewed as something transferred between objects, something that sets an object in motion, rather than an external factor that changes an object's motion. 5. An intuitive theory of the cosmos, where the Earth is viewed as a motionless plane orbited by the Sun, rather than a rotating sphere in orbit around the Sun. 6. An intuitive theory of the Earth, where geological features like continents and mountains are viewed as eternal and unchanging rather than transient and dynamic. We form these theories because we are built to perceive the environment in ways that are useful for daily living, but these ways do not map onto the true workings of nature. We perceive matter in terms of heft and bulk, not weight and size. We perceive thermal energy in terms of warmth and coldness, not heat and temperature. We perceive gravity as pulling us down, not pulling us toward the earth. We perceive velocity as a product of force, not a form of inertia. We perceive the earth as a flat plane, not a giant sphere. And we perceive geological systems in terms of discrete events, not continuous processes. These biased perceptions lead us down the wrong path when we theorize about the causes of natural phenomena, pushing us to draw distinctions that are empirically meaningless and to overlook distinctions that are empirically meaningful. Only scientific theories draw the right distinctions, and thus only scientific theories can furnish us with explanations and predictions that are consistently accurate and broadly applicable.